The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
It's very, very clear often who's going to lose from trade agreements, investment agreements. It's less clear who's going to benefit because the beneficiaries will only emerge in the course of the future and they don't know yet that they're going to win. So the losers clearly know what they're going to lose. The winners don't know what they're going to win. And that really pushes the question, why should we do this?
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Our guest today, Dr. Harold James, has been an expert in looking at globalization and the history of national cooperation worldwide. Now, we've been talking over the last couple of weeks, Dave, about this Trans-Pacific Partnership, trying to get our head around something that actually has been quite secretive. And I think Dr. James can probably bring some light to this issue.
Well, again, that is an issue which many people have been concerned with. We don't have full clarity on what it is. Most of the information that we've had on the Trans-Pacific Partnership was leaked information from Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. So it's been sort of as things have been released in small pieces, and then as parts of the agreement have been revealed, now we have some insight. So perhaps with a bit of a historical context, Harold James, it's great to have you back on the program with us. There are topics that you've researched and written on over the past 15 years, which make you the right person to explore trade and tariffs and the partnerships being proposed today, which might either increase the former or reduce the latter. Drawing on your expertise in political economy, let's frame the discussion on the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. We'll probably focus more on the TPP as it's already agreed on by the participant countries, but frame that for us.
Sure. The problem is that there's been a very, very efficient system of dealing with trade and manufacture. And basically, that's a system that goes back to the 19th century and goes back to some treaties in the 1860s. So it's really very, very old. But that deals just with manufactured goods. And, you know, we think of manufactured goods as important. But in fact, most of what the world is doing now is to do with services. And so this whole apparatus for dealing with manufactured goods just doesn't include the service sector. And the thought behind TPP and also the Atlantic version of this, TTIP, is that the trade agreements need to be extended in order to include the trade and services. And obviously, trade and services is something that the United States is good at. But in order to sell our services, we need to cooperate more with other countries and reach agreements with other countries.
You've said in some of your writing that tariffs are a traditional means of bargaining across frontiers. What are we bargaining for through the TPP and transatlantic agreements?
We're really hoping that we get more access to other countries' markets. There are some goods that are involved as well. One of the famous items that has been the subject of controversy for decades in TPP is the access to the Japanese food market. Japan has had a highly protectionist regime, and they have a particular culture, clearly, that's focused around the way that they produce and grow rice, and they don't want to admit foreign rice, including U.S. rice. That's the kind of thing we're trying to open up. But it's also to do with financial services, telecommunications, electronic commerce, intellectual property. All of those areas are areas where the United States has really big advantages. And I think opening up the trade now in the Asian countries and then in Europe in the future is something that most American businesses, I think, of as very advantageous to themselves.
You know, when you look at U.S. hegemony, we've really not been a leader as the British were by force. We preferred influence, perhaps, over control. And I think of the TPP perhaps as an outworking of a new international relations strategy, formalizing some sort of exchange of money for power, muscling into spheres in Asia, which might otherwise be dominated by less friendly world powers. We do have this advantage in financial services and intellectual property. Are we trying to solidify who we are as a hegemon?
I think you're right in identifying that as one of the motives, and it's one of the reasons that TPP is politically controversial, because it looks on the face of it as if it's a kind of coalition that excludes China. And if we're really worried about the growth of China, and if China's neighbors are worried about the military and security threat from China's TPP includes Vietnam and includes Japan, those are countries that are clearly quite worried about the growth of Chinese influence, and they're thinking of ways of protecting something against growth of China. So there is indeed a security element to it.
Would you view the BRICS summit as something of a counterweight to TPP then?
Yes, that's a different kind of initiative. And one of the curious things in the world today is the way in which monetary negotiations and trade negotiations go in different directions and they're conducted in different ways. You know, the story with the BRICS summit and now with the China Infrastructure Bank is that China's really building up a kind of financial alternative to the Bretton Woods system, which it corresponds very much to the model that you're thinking of, a model that was very heavily dominated by the United States.
As we look here in the United States, Labor says no, Sanders says no, Trump says no. Clinton said yes to the TPP as Secretary of State, but has retrenched that position. I'm curious, is it the centrist right that likes it? Is it the centrist left that likes it? Who promotes it? Who likes it? Why?
Well, I would have thought indeed that this was a kind of classical story of openness, that the center-right and the center-left like it, and the fringes of both parties and both ways of thought that mobilized to defeat it. But what you're saying is right. I was surprised that Hillary Clinton came out and really reversed her stance from just a few years ago, because she was talking about this agreement in Australia and Adelaide in November 2012 and saying that this was the gold standard in trade agreements. And, you know, I think she was right about that then. Why is she not saying that now? It's because both parties are really being pushed at the moment to the more extreme positions.
You know, we have the issue of protectionism, which often runs hand in hand with unemployment. Is it safe to predict pockets of protectionism in those parts of the world that suffer the most from unemployment? Or in the modern globalized economy, is currency devaluation sort of the better choice over tariffs and protectionism?
This is another of those areas where the trade issues and the money issues intersect, because in the wake of the financial crisis and the Great Recession, many countries or areas of the world have worked out that the easiest way to get a stimulus is to get some kind of currency devaluation. So the Japanese worked that out very clearly with Abenomics. The Europeans are really doing in effect that now. The quantitative easing of the ECB at the beginning of this year has really had the effect of driving down the euro against the dollar, and it has produced quite a strong revival in Europe. So all over the world, you're seeing countries devaluing, but there's one country that really can't do that strategy so well, and that's the United States. So we're kind of trapped in the situation where other countries manipulate their currencies against us. And one of the things that's leading, I think, to the build-up of reaction against TPP is the way in which the TPP doesn't include any currency manipulation agreements. In theory, the IMF could do something like that, but the IMF hasn't really touched that kind of issue in the past and is really unlikely to be effective in doing that in the future.
Just this issue, again, going back to Asia before we move too far away from it, the TPP is a part of our quote-unquote Asian pivot, according to the current White House. Is the TPP almost like setting a pick in basketball, more of a regional blocking move against Chinese expansionism?
The thinking behind it, and it's not framed as an explicit anti-Chinese move. The idea behind it is actually that China at some point will see that this is such an important area to enter into that China will negotiate in the same way as China negotiates with the WTO. It's kind of basically an extension of the WTO principles. But then that requires really an opening of China, and particularly intellectual property is one that concerns many American enterprises. But financial services is another area where there's a possible gain from the point of view of the United States.
There's also this One Belt, One Road project, which is fairly ambitious. And the question would be, will the existing world order, whatever that means, will they allow for the Chinese to complete a project which puts them at the center of 65% of the world population in terms of being a trade hub?
Clearly, it's something also that since the euro crisis, has been developing that many Europeans look to China as a way of helping them out of Chinese investment. Britain at the moment, just this week, is engaged in a very high-profile action of trying to welcome Chinese investment. There is this sense that doing things. Britain is doing things. Germany is doing things. Europeans as a whole are trying to negotiate with China, and the geopolitics of the world are shifting in a dramatic way. And that's why I think it's so important to think of TPP as something that provides a kind of counterweight to the Chinese way of doing things, but it doesn't exclude China at the same time. It actually creates, in the end, incentives for China to play along with the view of the world that we feel comfortable with.
There are, and perhaps this is sort of at the fringes of criticism, but there are concerns about the extra support that the TPP gives to corporations. There have been loud objections to the TPP, in fact, claiming that corporations or mega corporations are catered to in the agreement, and that it's nothing more than an attempt at sort of, how should we say it, maybe a transnational corporatism. How would you respond to that?
It's one of the areas where there's clearly going to be a lot of discussion and also of criticism, and that's part of particularly the left-wing critique of TPP. It focuses on some areas, in particular the protection of intellectual property, particularly pharmaceuticals. And there's clearly a question here of, in the public interest, to have pharmaceutical companies that do research and prepare and produce new pharmaceuticals, new drugs. And for that, some kind of protection for some period of time is important. If you can do generics immediately, nobody's ever going to innovate. But if you can keep your hold of the production process for a very, very long time, you're going to keep prices artificially high. And so the debate is how long that would be. My understanding of it is that the original term of the protection for the pharmaceutical industry is considerably reduced in the version that is now under consideration. And so in that sense, there's been a concession there for the critic.
Yeah, it may only be a theoretical concern, but with some historical basis, it was the interest groups that set the framework for corporatism in the 1920s and 30s. As you've written about, the RDI, the German, oh boy, I won't even try to pronounce it, but also the Federation of British Industry and others that contributed to major international trade agreements. And again, it's sort of the parameters of these trade agreements being set in the process of building coalitions and political interests around these special interest and pressure groups that lent itself towards, well, I mean, corporatism is the nice way of putting it, but what, again, perhaps maybe is a leftist critique, some sort of corporate fascism.
Right, and that was particularly, I think, true of the world of the 1930s. There were these big international cartels, and they produced goods that were not beneficial to consumers. You know, a famous example of this is the light bulb producers agreed to have light bulbs that wouldn't last as long as they should because they wanted people to buy new light bulbs all the time. There were plenty of instances of that, and in a sense, that was the view of the world that prevailed in the aftermath of a Great Depression, and where tariff boundaries are put up and companies then reach these informal agreements. And sense that I think you really need now is there needs to be some kind of counterweight to that. And the counterweight is exactly the idea of trade openness. So competition generally acts as a kind of break on this corporatism, which I completely agree is crippling, and you don't want the world to move in that direction. That's why, you know, this is a judgment call about how long, for instance, you protect particular patents. But the judgment call has to be weighted in the direction of competition at some stage. Otherwise, you're going to really stop the motor that produces novelty and innovation.
Perhaps you could help me with this. Is there a transnational monitor, a regulator, an adjudicator for these sorts of trade deals? And do they in any way compromise an existing rule of law?
I think this is more a European accusation for the negotiations on the transatlantic trade and investment partnership, is that the Europeans are going to be opened up to products, say, genetically modified food product that the democracies don't really want. And the protection of investment that's built into these treaties is going to be used as a device to overcome objections that Europeans might have against particular American products. And in Asia, there's something of the same debate about the labor protection measures that are put into TPP, that labor protection looks like a good idea to people in rich industrial countries. Sometimes people in poorer countries say it's a covert protectionism. So you get these pushbacks in the countries that we're negotiating with.
I don't know if you're familiar with Juan Zarate's book, Treasury's War, that he describes sort of a new era of Treasury Department involvement in foreign policy. A very interesting idea, just based on his time at the Treasury.
It's a brilliant book, yeah.
Is it possible, kind of relating back to the TPP, is it possible that in homogenizing trade relations, capital flows, and control over data transfers, all a part of the TPP, that again, the U.S. is merely putting itself in a better position to direct its foreign policy agendas?
That's exactly why there's going to be the pushback. And all these issues are kind of bundled in the popular imagination and the political imagination and the democratic debates in other countries. So, for instance, the issue of the big U.S. telecommunications companies and whether they're involved in the illegitimate surveillance of citizens in other countries, that's exactly feeding into the resentment. Or, you know, I think now in the wake of the corporate scandal in Volkswagen, that will also feed into the anti-TTIP sentiment in Germany because they believe that their jobs are at stake. The fact is that they've clearly manipulated their product in a really outrageous way, and they need some kind of response to that. They need some kind of punishment. But people in Europe are going to see it as costing European jobs.
It seems we might have missed an opportunity. I mean, I know all these agreements take time to settle on, but it's been in the process now for 5 years, and we're now in a very different place than we were, perhaps when the conversations were in their infancy. Post the global financial crisis, there's less coziness, perhaps as there was when trade was on the increase, everyone was making money. And it seems we're, to some degree, shifting away from globalization and witnessing a resurgence in national self-interest. Does that bode well for either the ratification of the TPP or moving forward with the European version?
I completely agree with that diagnosis. Since the financial crisis, there's much more of a focus on national agendas. There's a worry about losing jobs to globalization. That was already there before the financial crisis, but clearly the shock to employment drives that kind of feeling. And I think these periods of trade opening and then closing again, there's always an issue. It's very, very clear often who's going to lose from trade agreements, investment agreements. It's less clear who's going to benefit because the beneficiaries will only emerge in the course of the future and they don't know yet that they're going to win. So the losers clearly know what they're going to lose. The winners don't know what they're going to win. And that really pushes the question, why should we do this? So the pushback in the United States, which I think is remarkable, and Hillary Clinton's change of style in talking about this trade issue, I think is the most dramatic example of that. That really is an indication of the way in which the world is moving. And, you know, what I think you should do if you stand back from this debate a bit is see that in the end, this open world economy has been very, very beneficial for the United States. And it's been beneficial for most of the world most of the time.
Clearly. Maybe this question centers on sort of domestic politics and employment. But if we imagine global GDP as a pie, when the pie grows, everyone seems to get along. And that's what we've had. Certainly the openness you describe in the world economy, it's been massively beneficial to us, to everyone. But if the pie shrinks, then politicians begin to seek to maintain the old slice of pie, which prioritizes, as we said, national self-interest over international interests and often cuts into someone else's piece, so to say. We talked about this earlier in terms of currency devaluation as a tool towards maintaining that slice of pie in the tradable goods sector, keeping that previous level of trade. These are trends which may not suggest increased globalization and trade cooperation. How do we get away from sort of domestic political myopia and the constraints that, say, the political leadership in the United States has coming into an election year where employment and employment politics rises to the surface?
So what you're saying really is that in order for these agreements to be attractive and look politically right, the pie has to expand or the cake has to grow. We need more to distribute. And the more that we feel that the world is just kind of shrinking pie, a shrinking cake, the less we're likely to agree. And the more we're going to say, what we need to do is to get advantages at the expense of somebody else. But I think that's exactly where it really helps to look back at historical examples. When that kind of contraction took place and when the world became more nationalistic and more conflictual, and that's really the story of the 1930s, it was a dismal period, terrible, terrible crimes. And, you know, in 1945, the consensus that you don't want ever to go back to that world was the world that drove the engagement of the United States and the Bretton Woods institutions in the United Nations and so on. You know, then in the end, you get the growth that is going to sustain a process of openness. But at the beginning, people didn't see that. So in a sense, I don't know what the recipe really is, except to just think back on historical episodes. You can never win, really, by growing at the expense of your neighbor. Both sides really suffer from that, and there are very, very clear historical lessons in that area.
Perhaps you can explore with me the changes in political and trade relationships when a country goes into formal default, a sovereign default. How does the trade map change? I mean, we live in an era where sovereign default is not a strange concept and is, in fact, likely in some parts of the world. In the 1930s, Argentina remained very, shall we say, Brit-centric and kept up their debt service to ensure healthy terms of trade. Brazil, on the other hand, defaulted, and they shifted away from trade with the United States and started working with Nazi Germany instead. So where we have too much debt in the system and default is likely, how does the geopolitical and trade map change?
It's clearly true that some countries today have got levels of debt that they can't really handle. The problem is that if one country defaults, it can start a kind of vicious spiral or a domino game in which investors generally get nervous, so they withdraw their money from countries that look similar to the country that's defaulting. So rescue attempts in the aftermath of these defaults have to look both at dealing with the aftermath of default and limiting the contagion. When contagious defaults happen, I think you really do get then this tipping into the cycle of more nationalism, more protectionism, and so on. So, you know, again, the question is really what can be done to make for more innovation, more dynamism, what can link the world more effectively, and how can people who have good ideas really put those ideas over so that a wide group of people benefit. But, you know, individual defaults, I think, clearly need to be addressed if the country has an absolutely impossible debt level. So the Europeans are dealing with this at the moment. In the case of Greece, it will surely be an issue in European politics for the years to come. But you know, what they also need to do is to work out a way that that doesn't affect other vulnerable countries in the European periphery.
Russia and China have been somewhat salvific for a few countries that have come under pressure. Greece and Cyprus comes to mind in terms of doing some different deals and investment programs in their hour of need. I guess that's kind of what I have in mind in terms of a shifting of political loyalties in the context of solving a debt problem. Maybe this is something that we get past sooner than later, but it still, from a grand strategy standpoint, seems as if the United States is, through these two policies, the TPP and the transatlantic, trying to create a context where we maintain. Is that fair? Is our foreign policy and these trade agreements, are these inextricably linked?
I agree with that. I think it does make sense as a foreign policy measure. I'm not sure that these efforts in Greece or in Cyprus to get Russia to intervene in some kind of way are really very productive. It seems to me that there's a lot of bluster about this. There wasn't really a realistic possibility of a lot of Russian help, or a lot of Chinese help is even more improbable, because why should China, in a moment that the economy is slowing down, waste a lot of resources in the small European marginal countries? They don't want to do that. But what you're pointing to is, I think, right, that the general process of disintegration and fragmentation that's been there since the financial crisis lends itself to strategies of countries like Russia trying to pick holes in it. And, you know, I think you can think of the refugee crisis as another instance of the same kind of thing. The refugee crisis is clearly undermining the Europeans, but Russian policy in Syria is actually pushing the refugee crisis and making it worse.
There was a quote that you had in your book, The End of Globalization, from Mr. Kindleberger, where he says that once British hegemony was lost and nothing was there to take its place, international relations collapsed into anarchy. And my question to you, Dr. James, is U.S. hegemony worth keeping? What are the costs of losing or forfeiting it?
I'm not completely happy with the idea of U.S. hegemony. You know, clearly, the United States has a smaller share of the world economy now than it did in 1945. And that's actually good, because it helps to make other areas more stable. When they grow, we wouldn't want to return to the world of 1945 when half of the manufacturing is in the United States. But What I think you're really thinking of, and what is important, is the idea of an open, liberal international trading system with the rule of law, where contracts are enforced and where people can rely on some kind of continuity. And you know, that's the world that, in the wake of big financial crises, Kindleberger thought about the Great Depression. He was terrified that something like the Great Depression might happen again. That's exactly the world when these threats come up again.
Now, the reality is we have very tepid growth globally, and in the U.S., depending on the measures you're looking at, they've been not too impressive, given the amount of stimulus put into the system from monetary policy measures. Let's say, for instance, that we revisit some version of the global financial crisis. We haven't normalized interest rates. I know this is taking us away from the TPP conversation, but if we've not normalized interest rates, would you argue for the necessity of fiscal policy measures?
Yes, I mean, that's one area I think there is some room for maneuver, and particularly in the low interest rate environment. I think many people have made this point that it really makes sense to do infrastructure projects because it's very cheap to borrow for credible governments like the government of the United States or the UK or even the Japanese government. But you do have to think of the future and to think of whether the infrastructure that you're creating is useful or not. If it's not useful, if you're building bridges to nowhere, obviously you're going to have lots of additional costs in the future, servicing and maintaining useless projects. You don't want to do that. But if you can really identify gaps in the infrastructure that need to be filled, this is surely the right moment to do that. And the Europeans should see that, and the United States should see that as well.
This maybe ties into the recent presidential debate, and I'll bring this topic up in just a minute. Government spending, of course, is what we're talking about when we're talking about fiscal policy measures. If there's not an increase in the revenues of government, then we're really talking about deficit spending. So to avoid radical deficit figures, we are talking about an increase in revenues. That's corporate taxes, that's individual taxes, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, from a recent presidential debate, I think it was Hillary Clinton who said, of course we can spend this money. We're going to take it from the wealthy. And it makes me come back to this issue within the TPP where we live in an era of extreme capital mobility. And if fiscal policies are implemented that require government spending, government doesn't want to necessarily rack up a huge long-term liability, why would individuals stick around? You've got Hirschman's classic exit option, which seems to loom in an age of capital mobility. You already have corporations who've done that and parked all their cash overseas. Why wouldn't wealthy individuals just say, thank you, no thank you, we're gone?
There's a logic in that position, but there's a logic in the other position as well that says if you want to engage in this kind of higher tax environment, then you need to control capital mobility in some way. And, you know, there are many signs that not just in the United States, but in other countries as well, that we're moving more into the world where capital mobility is likely to be controlled. But I think your hunch there, as it were, is quite correct that the next time that a big financial crisis hits, and people really expect now where it's going to come from, the likelihood is that it will be an emerging market crisis, is that there will be much more of a backlash against the open capital mobility. And you know, then you go back essentially to the world of the 1950s and 60s, where it was very difficult to move capital, and countries can inflate or they can have higher taxes. So inflation is another way of having higher taxes, and they finance themselves in that way. So, you know, there is a kind of coherence about this view. I think that the case for greater infrastructure spending now is not really that needs to be financed by higher taxes, but it's very, very cheap to borrow. And so we get a kind of version of we can really do something for almost nothing. That's the powerful argument for doing something, and not that we need a high tax regime to do it.
So rather than focusing on sort of transfer payments, really making sure that whatever infrastructure projects are proposed and accepted have some sort of positive rate of return relative to the debt service.
Exactly. And, you know, that's, I think, also why it's important to ensure that these are public-private partnerships and that private capital is also willing to get engaged in that. That's generally a sign that there's a good expectation of a proper rate of return.
Is there anything in the last few years that has surprised you? You have a lot of historical context, whether it's looking at European families that have been in business through the centuries or looking at the interwar period and crisis in Europe and the United States. With the historical background that you have, What has surprised you in the last few years, if anything?
Well, I get surprised when people think that the crisis is over. I mean, in fact, this is a kind of really complicated system of dislocations that hit first particularly badly the United States, and then everybody said, well, it's just an American crisis. Then it hit the Europeans, and then people said it's to do with the peculiar way in which the euro was set up. And now it's hitting the emerging markets, and people say it's peculiar to the emerging markets. But you know, actually, it's sort of deeply built into the logic of the flows that you get a particular problem. People find solutions to it, but the solutions create other problems. And we're really living in that world where the solutions that we had that were in some ways quite effective after 2008 are creating new problems. And we need to think of ways of minimizing the impact of those new problems.
What would you see as the most critical of the new problems we have to address?
I think both the combination of the idea that currency wars are back on the agenda and the need to extend international trade agreements to services as well as to manufacturers. Those are in a way, in the past, in the reaction to the Great Depression, it's necessary to work on both those fronts.
I remember you saying something in your book on family capitalism, that family capitalism has been particularly important in countries and societies experiencing profound shocks and discontinuities, that it's in fact a way of managing risk in a high-risk environment. And it would seem that in an age of slow economic growth, that the mega corporation might come under pressure, maybe even be replaced by private capital, private enterprise, whether it is of a familial nature or something like private equity, but just where it's something that's a little bit more low profile. How would you reflect on that, again, as we look at a changing world, a world, as you say, that may still be in crisis? How do families and individuals best navigate that?
That's right. The big corporation was a product and feature of a particular stage of development. It was really, in a way, a stage of development when it was very difficult to have market processes in some areas. And the new technology allows a great deal more subcontracting, and it allows leaner enterprises. So I expect the world of big corporations actually to be quite turbulent. And it's quite a difference to the 20th century, where big corporations really survived through the century. Now we're seeing a considerable turbulence, and lots of famous names are disappearing. If you have an idea of innovation, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it needs a culture and a climate around it that's supportive of innovation.
Well, as we wrap up, I want to thank you for your contribution, not only for the commentary, but you continue to write prolifically, and I'm appreciative of it. The library continues to grow. I have the Harold James shelf, and it's a pretty substantial shelf. So appreciate your contribution. Every time I glance through one of those volumes again, the level of scholarship, the commitment to excellence, the degree of insight, I'm glad there's a few of you out there, because you do open the world in a unique way to those of us who are not in the professional academic sphere.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, it's very nice of you to say that, but you know, you really have great questions, and the questions that you asked today are just on the forefront, I think, of what the political agenda should be.
We'll look forward to continuing the conversation in future years, and we wish you well there at your work at Princeton.
All the best to you. And thank you again. It's great talking to you.
Thank you.
I always enjoy Harold James, Dave, when he's on the show, and his books, like you said, they just uncover so much. But when we're talking about globalization, and when we're talking about the destruction of globalization, which has been a key theme that he's written on, what we're talking about is, what direction do we go in a crisis? And he said one of the things that has surprised him, I'm glad you asked that question, is how many people think that the crisis has passed, yet the crisis has just transferred. He mentioned the emerging markets is where the crisis is right now. But one of his concerns was, ultimately, we may see capital controls as this crisis unfolds again.
And it's not surprising to see capital controls in the world where currency wars are more of an issue.
Right.
He's pointed out in one of his books that, in fact, if you see capital flight from a country of greater than 3 to 5% of GDP, it's likely to cause a domestic, if not an international, crisis.
Right.
So when you begin to see capital flight, which might be considered a hot money flow out of the country where speculative investment dollars came in and now speculative investment dollars are flowing out, that outflow sucks major life out of, you know, a very small economy, and quite frankly, even a large economy, because we've seen the same thing happen in developed European countries, where again, 3, 4, 5% of GDP, if that's the scale of capital flight, you find yourself in the middle of economic crisis, and now the powers that be are doing everything that they can to batten down the hatches and make sure it doesn't get worse. Enter stage left, capital controls.
Which is exactly what you brought up last week in last week's show. Last week you said, what if the government actually starts targeting the money? I mean, you're talking about it going into mattresses, gold, cash, what have you. If the government is targeting money, people are going to probably hide that money.
It's interesting because mattress money, if you want to call it that, is really no different than a form of capital flight. You can have foreign direct investment into an emerging market and have that money leave, and it basically was available capital for investment. And when it gets sucked out, it creates a tightness in credit, and it creates a real desperation for liquidity. It creates a panic. Well, the same thing can happen if enough people just put money in the mattress and don't want to participate in the economy at that particular point. Maybe it's because they're concerned about volatility in the stock market, the bond market, or they have a basic insecurity relating to the constant value of a currency in question. But again, you'll see desperate governments do desperate things, and it's right at the margin, 3 to 5% of GDP of capital flight or money coming out of an economy, and you have a real, real problem.
You know, I think the verdict is still out, Dave, even after listening to Harold James and you talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The verdict is out for me in that I don't know whether to come down on the support side or the go against side, only for the fact that if it increases globalization, this is something that a lot of people miss. If it increases globalization, you actually have less in the way of controls. Globalization is a positive for the world. I'm not talking about necessarily a one-world controlled government, but globalization is the free exchange of trade, services, information, that type of thing. If indeed it's just a reaction, however, to the end of globalization, and it turns into stringent types of controls, I would be against it.
Well, I think that's fair. And to the degree that it promotes individual autonomy, the individual actor choosing being entrepreneurial, starting a new venture, expanding it overseas, et cetera, brilliant. We give it kudos. On the other hand, if it's catering to special interest groups and lobby groups, and as a consolidation of power and sort of tying political interests to business interests in almost a fascist footstep, then obviously it's something that's problematic from the get-go.
But one thing we can come to an agreement on is that the crisis still is here, and we're seeing solutions unfolding and, you know, the consequences of those solutions. I think we have to continue to study this and talk to the people who are in the know.
That's right. Looking at the knock-on effects of the policy measures put in place during the global financial crisis is the next issue. Just as we learned from 2001 and 2002, the solutions to that crisis led to the next crisis. The solutions to the 2008-09 crisis will lead to the next crisis, and we've got to pay attention to, again, what those knock-on effects are and the ways that we should be positioning ahead of that.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Dr. Harold James. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.